Anyway, getting back to Istanbul, Turkey. Had an incredible trip over there. That was 2 weeks ago, two Sabbaths ago. We were actually there talking in a hotel room. They put us way up top. We had an incredible view of the Bosphorus River that runs through there. That Bosphorus River runs through there, very, very wide, very, very deep, because they have all kinds of ships out there just constantly running through that area. Asia being on the other side, we were on the European side. Very unique city. They have a bridge that we could see from the window there, just in part of the horizon there, an incredible view. In that respect, it looks like the Golden Gate. They call it their Golden Gate. Some of them do anyway, that we heard there. There are a tremendous amount of people traveling back and forth, 2 million a day, back from Asia coming into Europe to work. Most of them work on the European side. And they travel across the bridges that are there, as well as by boat, ferries, different things going across there constantly out there. And a lot of large number of cruise ships that come into Istanbul. So quite a tourist area, but really amazing. 13 million people live there. And as I mentioned last Sabbath, 3 million more that are going to come through what's going to happen right here in the United States. You think that's an awesome thing to understand. But again, here, mostly Muslim, that particular area of the world. There are minarets all over the city. If you know what those are, they're on the sides of mosques, anywhere from one. Most have two. Some have more. There was one there that has six. I believe it's the Blue Mosque, isn't it? That has six. A very well-known mosque in that part of the world. And minarets are the towers that they have where the prayers come out different times in the day. Matter of fact, one time we were out there on a balcony on one of the floors looking over the Bosphorus, and at the time that some of those started. And really quite incredible hearing the sound vibrate through the whole city, because they have different times that they all do basically about the same time, but you can still hear it. You can hear it coming out of Asia, coming across the Bosphorus, or so many across there that sound just traveled across toward you, as well as throughout the city around you. With 8,000 and some mosques there, there are like 120 or so churches, and then there are like 13 synagogues. So shows you a bit of the percentages of what is taking place here. I think 98% is Muslim. So quite an interesting city in the sense of understanding its history, one of the oldest, obviously, of things that are there in the world. I wish I had some of my stats here. I don't have it, but I think of the one building. It just shows you a confusion of religion and what one being has done on this earth to confuse mankind. The one place that is a museum today, very well known, it's Hagia Sophia. It is the largest building there, construction, if I remember my stats here correctly. But it was made a church in the beginning by Justinian in the city of Constantinople. And this was during the if you know the history of some of the things we know about the Roman Empire and the revivals of the Roman Empire, Constantine, the city became known as Constantinople, and then Justinian later on had the and that was in 300 and some. I wish I had my stats here, but I think my just serving my memory with my memory nowadays on some of those things. I know how good this is, but anyway, it was I think 300 and some, 320, 325, somewhere in there. A.D., that it was built as a church. And then later on in the 1400s, I believe it was, some sultan conquered it, became a mosque after that. And then in like early 1900s, 1930, 35, somewhere near, it became a museum. So again, just showing, you go back that far, as I mentioned last Sabbath, you know, when we visited different places there in Europe, and you see some of the buildings, and most of them are churches, that are the oldest. Sometimes when you're in England, United Kingdom, there are some old castles there. But if you get back 1,000 years, you're doing quite good to find structures that have different things that are built there. But to think all the way back to 300 and some A.D., it shows you how old that crossroads is between Europe and Asia and through there. And even if you look on a map, all the places located there in Turkey, it's quite incredible. All the mail route that is used for prophecy in the Book of Revelation, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Laodicea, Philadelphia, all of them in through there. They're all located in Turkey. All those old cities where Paul traveled. Then, of course, he went across on into some of the areas across there, into Greece, different areas through there, and then jump a little bit farther over again. You get to Italy, where he finally ended up in Rome. But, just quite interesting seeing some of the history and the things that make for what people are today. Again, there was a lot that was impressed upon my mind there concerning one major religion, that all descendants that come from the God of Abraham. I get a lot of flack over that in email oftentimes, because I'll get to that in the sermon today. But people get really upset when you mention about the God of Abraham. and that three religions have come from, basically from the lineage of Abraham. And they don't get it. They don't understand, but boy, they think they do, and they get so upset, and they correct you on different things, and they have no idea what they're talking about. But anyway, I get a charge out of that sometimes, just showing the ignorance of man when man thinks he has so much knowledge, so much understanding. I know I was thinking this past week here, going through some things for some future sermons, thinking about how puny, how small we are as human beings. We have no concept of the great God, and the honor that is shown God is nil and void. And yet man should be in such awe of the great Almighty God who sustains everything in the universe. And we get so lifted up with pride with how important we are. And we are absolutely nothing. It really boggles the mind. The more we learn, the more we come to understand how puny, how small we are, and how great God really is. So anyway, I'm amazed at the time we live in. I'm thankful for the time we live in. And we'll probably hear some of the things about that particular part of the world later on as they have affected my thinking. Seems like a lot of those things do when we don't realize why perhaps a certain area we've been in has an effect on us, but it does, and I think it will in the future as well. But anyway, that brings us all the way up to the sermon for today. We'll get into that. Going back into the Red Book, the second book, 2008, God's Final Witness. We have several more chapters to be covered in this. I think one more chapter in the other book to be covered yet before all these are up and running on the internet. So the people can listen to these if they don't have the ability to read, if they're not reading or whatever, or they prefer to listen. And obviously adding a lot more in the sermons in this format than what's written in either book. But I think it's good to go through this. We're going to go through chapter 3 starting today with a new series. Time has run out for man. Time has run out for man, the title of the sermon. I'm going to be reading here in the book and commenting on some things as we go along. The true history of man is not what you have been taught at school. What have you been taught concerning your history? Much of what we learn about the history of man depends upon where we live. If you live in China, the history taught is much different from the history taught in Japan. You know, just over World War II. Everyone's prejudice. Everyone has different things that are part of the mind that mold and fashion the way we think. I think of different nationalities. I think of the scattered nations of Israel and where they are today. And there is that which is passed down from generation to generation to generation, just as much as I mentioned in the past, that serpent on a pole, you know, that goes all the way back to the Exodus. And that which Israel thought had healing power in it, that they begin to use as a symbol for healing. And here we see it running around, you know, it's on our ambulances. When we see ambulances run by, it's in hospitals and so forth. Serpent on a pole. I was amazed to see it in Luxembourg when we were there in Europe on one of the coat of arms. And I don't know how old that was, but that's the first time I've seen a coat of arms with a lion on one part of the coat of arms and on the other part, that old serpent on the pole. You know, amazing. And that's exactly how human beings are. Things have been passed down from generation to generation to generation that mold and fashion the way we think about other people. And I think of the world today, how it doesn't get along. Look at the Middle East and look at the prejudices that go so far back. Some of this came out in Istanbul as one of the individuals on one of the tours was telling us the difference in why certain things took place of two different splits, Shia and Sunni, and why they think the way they do and why there's such hatred. You know, they're blowing up each other's mosques now in Iraq. You know, incredible. And they're fighting against each other in Gaza. You know, they cannot get along. Christianity doesn't get along with each other, oh, to a degree, until things get really nasty and gets down the line who is right. It's incredible how man thinks. But these things have been passed down. Those things that are happening over there in the Middle East, we have no concept here in this country. They've been passed down from generation to generation, deep-rooted prejudices and bitterness and anger that they've been taught by their parents and their parents before them and their parents before them, and that's how it gets passed down from generation to generation. It's going to take God to come in here and clean up this world, and that's what he's getting ready to do. So again, going in the book, if you live in China, the history taught is much different from the history taught in Japan, whether it is recent or ancient. What someone is taught in Israel is different from what one is taught in Germany or Egypt. The history of man is different in Greece than it is in Italy. And so it goes. I mention those because there are prejudices in every one of those peoples toward those other countries. Whatever one they live in. Well, how Egyptians think about Israelis and what Israelis or Judah thinks about Egypt. They're different totally different. Deep, deep prejudice. Emotions that get inflamed and stirred up. Greece and Italy. You know, and the things that go way, way back when we were in Greece a few years back. And some of them that would talk openly about Italy. There are deep resentments there. And even about Turkey. And one individual still rings in my mind talking about how, you know, he's talking about some of these different nations. He says, in Turkey, they're our enemy. No, they're not at war, but there are things that go way, way back. And Italy, they made it very clear that they have a hatred. So many of them have a hatred toward Italy because of what they did to them in World War II, what the Italians did when they joined up with Hitler, you know, in World War II, and what they did toward Greece. So, you know, these things go way, way back, and they are passed down from generation to generation. Going back to the book, and so it goes. Man manipulates his outlook on the past by his vision of the present and the future. As shown in the last chapter, there are many lies about our history, the history of man. As an aside, yet pertinent to the subject of this chapter, and something that will be covered more thoroughly later, it is due to the European viewpoint of European history that a new Europe is rising. You know, they have deep-rooted feelings and sentiment about their past and about what they have been at different times in their history. We don't have that here in the United States. You know, we're oblivious here in this country. I get so sick of the way we are in this country. I get so sick of the news. There is no news. It's commentary. And whatever they make up and whatever they want to focus in on. And some of the things we focus on and want to make newsworthy. You think, and this has an impact on the world? You know, certain things that happen by certain movie stars and some that have to go to jail on occasion? Oh, boo-hoo. Let's just hear about it. Let's hear about it every day. Let's hear about it every hour on the hour. And I can't tell you how sick I get of it. You can't get anything of what's happening in the world unless you find something on the internet or you know of some means to hear about what's happening around the rest of the world. It's hard to find certain news. It really is. When you hear of something, you just get a blurb here in this country. But Europeans, you know, there's that which goes way, way back, and it does affect their thinking. It truly does in a very powerful way. And it has everything to do with what's coming. With 10 nations that are going to give their nod, their approval, in a moment. Not for a long time. And some of them are going to deeply regret it shortly after they've done it. They truly are. It's going to be one of those occasions that there are going to be certain spirit beings that move them, that bring them to a certain point in time, that they're going to agree that they need to intervene and they need to form together as one strong power block. And they're going to do to this country and to Canada and different countries all at one whack to intervene, to begin to take control of certain things in the world. And once you start it, you can't turn the clock back. Once you do it, you can't turn it back. And they're going to be loosely fit together, just like it talks about in different prophecies, just like in Daniel, clay and iron doesn't really fit together. But it's together. But it's not a close thing. It's one out of necessity, one out of circumstance, one out of time and chance that happens to them. But anyway, going back to the book, other areas of the world are ignorant of the growing forces in the heart of Europe that are working for a United States of Europe. This is important to understand because it has much to do with a rapidly approaching World War III. The heart of Europe thirsts for a revival or a revived Europe of old. In other words, that prestige, that power. Man hungers after power and wealth. And there is that hunger over there. And there is a bitterness toward the United States. There is that which is underlying because much of the world, and especially those who are emerging with greater power, have deep resentment and bitterness towards us because we're always telling the world how to live and what to do. And the world doesn't like that. And they're tired of the bullying and the politics and the things that go on, even though they do the same things. They just don't see themselves. All they can see is us or this country. The heart of Europe thirsts for a revived Europe of old, and God has revealed that they will attain it and become the strongest power the earth has ever known. Even as I write, only yesterday, there was news from Europe that reported on a Belgian leader's new book. And here is a quote that was in the news. In a bid to go against the Eurosceptic tide that is dominating EU public opinion, Belgian Prime Minister Guy Verhofstadt has pleaded for the creation of a federal United States of Europe. Mr. Verhofstadt, a liberal, on Thursday, December the 1st, 2005, presented his new book, provocatively entitled The United States of Europe. Isn't that amazing? Leaders, people that form opinion and thought and politics that have very powerful influence as to what's taking place. And it's coming out exactly what they believe, things that Mr. Armstrong said a long time ago, as God gave him understanding of things that happened in Europe and a revival that had to take place one more time. Amazing. Going on. This leader and many others like him embrace a billowing passion for a powerful united Europe. This insatiable thirst is fueled in large part by deep roots from their past, which inflame a burning desire for a renewed future. History is unique in the eyes of the beholder, but man's true history can only be seen through the truth of his relationship with God. This is a reason man is blind to his true history. He has not wanted God to have too close of a relationship with him. Through time, many have used the name of God, but have not wanted to do as he said. The hypocrisy in man runs deep. I mentioned earlier then in the beginning of this how that I am rebuked oftentimes for various things, one of them being anything mentioning about Islam and what I've said there about the job I have been given and as a prophet and so forth, especially to the three major religions that basically come from the descendants of Abraham. And people get upset by that. And some get upset that I would say anything bad about Judaism, because after all, as some emails put it in different kinds of terms, they're the chosen people of God. Who are you to say anything negative or bad? And I generally send them a short little blurb and say, well, you know, when Jesus Christ came along 2,000 years ago, he had something to say about that. Call them snakes in the grass, hypocrites, and so forth. You know, people don't think about those things that Christ addressed. They like to see him as a little baby or, you know, as this a wimp, you know, that goes around with his head hung down and pious in his appearance and so forth, and just talking about love and love your neighbor, and that's all they see. And they don't understand the correction he gave to mankind and what they were doing at that time, you know, and using the name of God, and yet he condemned all of Judaism 2,000 years ago, and it's much worse today than what it was 2,000 years ago. And so the whole reason these things are taking place at the end time is because all three religions are to receive correction. They're all wrong. Look at what they're doing. Look at the Middle East. You know, talking about religion as the cause of this world's problems. It is the primary cause of this world's problems. It truly is. You know, just, it's mind-boggling. Shia and Sunni. Well, if you can't kill each other fast enough, you know, somebody bombs one of them's mosque, go and have retaliation and bomb a few of theirs. Well, they're just getting the job started early. It's going to be done. You know, a lot of things are going to be raised to the ground. They're getting an early start. Amazing. They hate each other. They can't stand each other. And just like on the tour guide we had there in Istanbul, a little perturbed, being Muslim himself, a little perturbed the people over there weren't getting along. In Iraq, you know, with each other. They look down upon them, you know, because they see themselves as one religion as a, in that respect, and that they should all get along. Well, they don't. In different factions and so forth, you know, people cannot rule themselves. It's amazing what's taking place over there right now. Then the problems with Judaism, the conflict there with Islam, they can never get along. I don't care if we had a million years in front of us as human beings, we'd have to be held back in what we could do to each other as far as destruction is concerned, but never any peace with man. Man does not know the way of peace, truly doesn't. I think of why Mr. Armstrong was received by a lot of world leaders and the respect they had toward him, because he had a message. A lot of people condemned him for it because he didn't talk about God enough. He didn't quote Scripture enough when he talked to world leaders. Well, those blooming idiots, that's what they were. Blooming idiots, not understanding what he was saying, had everything to do with what God says, what God gives. He had a message that different leaders understood. Man does not know the way of peace. Man has a selfish nature. They clicked with that. They knew that to be true. There are a lot of world leaders out there. They're not stupid. A lot of them do have desire and concern for the world, generally for their selfish part of the world, but still for the world. And they understand what conflict does. And there are those who would like to see or wanted to see peace with different countries and so forth between different peoples. And so he was received, and God gave him favor because of that, because of a message that needed to go out. But very much about what God is telling the world. Man does not know the way to peace. Because you know what it is? It's God's law. It's God's law. It's the Ten Commandments. And man doesn't want that. He'd rather worship God on Friday or Sunday, say, than when God says to do it. And if he does know the truth, then he wants to twist and distort that worship on those days or change certain times like Passover. Distort and twist what God has given. And so as I was mentioning, I think of some emails I received recent time here talking about, oh, I wish I'd say some of those, but it wouldn't do any good. I'd just delete them. Generally, I send them an email back just to... It's kind of like what God did in Egypt when he was a humbling Pharaoh. He would soften his heart at times by plagues and then remove it and harden his heart because it was his own heart. It was Pharaoh's own heart. He was just responding to the circumstances around him. And sometimes I write back to individuals just giving them something to chew on a little bit, and it stirs them up in a deeper resentment and hatred toward what is true. But at least it brings out their true colors, even those who call themselves Christian who get upset sometimes and then after about a couple of emails call me all kinds of things that show what they really believe when they use words I wouldn't repeat. And, you know, if I read some of those, I'd have to be bleeping them on a regular basis. Bleep, bleep, a couple of words, bleep, then a couple of words, bleep. Yeah, they really are close to God, aren't they? You know, really nice Christians. But anyway, some recently, at recent time, talk about, don't you know where the crescent moon came from? And they start ranting and raving about paganism and about all these bad beliefs that are in Islam. And don't you know where they got some of their different ideas and the word for God and so forth? Well, you know what? The word they use for God and what they believe. My wife, I'll probably get sidetracked here, never get back on course. Going back to this part of the story here, but my wife asked me a question to ask the guide there one day. And I know we were given certain favor there with him. We happened to be on a tour the second day, and he happened to be on that tour. It was a totally different kind of tour, but he was there as well on that one. But anyway, he was talking about Mecca and about the pilgrimage to Mecca, that once in a lifetime as a whole, those who are able to go are expected to go to Mecca, the Hajj, they call it, and take this journey there, pilgrimage there, in honor to Abraham. Now, a lot of people don't know that. It's to honor Abraham. And so she asks the question, says, well, who do they feel is greater, Abraham or Muhammad? Good question. Who do they feel is greater? Because they don't do anything like that in honor of Muhammad, but they do for Abraham. And so I ask him, and it kind of caught him off guard. I don't think he'd probably ever been asked a question. And cutting him out a little bit, but he said, Muhammad. And ask why. Because if they do this once in a lifetime in order to go to Mecca, and it's in honor of Abraham. And he said, well, Muhammad was the last prophet. Now, it didn't hit me at the moment what he was talking about until he mentioned some other things later on. Then it still didn't hit me at that moment. Because he said, later on we were talking, and he said something about, you know, basically what they believe is Moses was a prophet. Jesus Christ was a prophet. But Muhammad was the last prophet. That's what they believe. So even there, they give a recognition to certain things, what they believe in their past, but Muhammad is the last prophet, so he's the greatest. He's the more important and the one to be looked up to in the greatest way. So I thought that, you know, a different perspective there of seeing how they think and where they're coming from. But I think of the other two religions then, Judaism and Christianity, and what they think and what they believe. And it's amazing the things that are there in the mind. But, you know, as people were getting back to the story here, about some who are upset because of that crescent moon and because of their beliefs and so forth, and don't you know how bad that is, and these bad ideas, and I think, well, you're so much better because you worship the sun. That's really what it boils down to. Because you see, what they believe is that same God of Abraham, even though certain things are twisted, just as much as Judaism in the time of Christ talked about Abraham and Moses and the prophets and so forth, but they didn't do what God said. You know, you can talk and use God's name. It's like today when people use the name of God and Jesus Christ in traditional Christianity. It's not God and it's not Jesus Christ any more than what the Jews believed 2,000 years ago that Jesus Christ condemned them for. He basically told them that is not what God, that's not God, what you believe and what you worship. You've created your own. And they didn't get it. They didn't understand. See? And it's just like today. There are those who think they're better and what they are worshiping is better. I thought, what's better? To have a crescent moon, you know, that you worship, that you have as a symbol of your part of your worship, or sun, the sun. Sunday, that's when you come together. That's when you worship God. Don't you know where that comes from? You know, aren't you so much better than other religions in the world? They're not any better. They're such, I hope you understand what I'm talking about. Yeah. Having some blank looks out there. That. But anyway, so incredible, isn't it? You know. The hypocrisy in man. And that's why I got off on this direction. The last sentence we read, the hypocrisy in man runs deep. It truly does. And everybody thinks they're right. And the smugness of traditional Christianity. I'm looking forward to some more of the job I have ahead of me. I truly am. Because right now nobody's really listening. Hence, no need for interviews. The seeds have been planted. They truly have. You need to think about, you know, the size we are. I hate to get into some other sermons in the future, but plant some seeds here. You know, you think about what we are. We are small. We were talking this morning here about some groups that like to ask the question when they know you're smaller. Well, how many did you have at the Feast of Tabernacles? Different ones. How many ministers were there? You know, they want to try to poke a knife in there, you know, because they know how large you are, or how small you are. And it's like this makes them feel better because they have so many thousand in the group. And you think, you know, I don't care if you have 20,000 or 25,000 or less than that, but that's puny in the scheme of things in this world. So it was mentioned here, was it 40,000 people? Is one organization just up north here has? Or 20-some thousand that belong to this one group right here in the Cincinnati area. And this one group that's fairly new, I guess, as far as a religious following and so forth. And that's just in one city area, basically. And here, some have to scrape and scrounge around the world to get 20,000, and it's nothing, you know, in the scheme of things. Well, we are smaller, much, much, much smaller. And I marvel at that. And sending out the thousands of books we do, it's nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. If you look at it for what it is on a physical plane. But with what God is doing and what God is preparing to do, it's powerful. Truly is. What he's going to do in the future, they're just like little seeds, little mustard seeds, but when it's time to grow, it'll grow fast. When it's God's time, things are thrust forward very powerfully so. So, hence my comment about I'm looking forward. I really am. I'm looking forward to the opportunity I have because God has made me what I am to this day, brought me to this point in time where I think of even the last two books here. The first book was kind of a preparation for this one here, actually. To get me ready to do some things, even in the interviews, people have noted that there are differences in the way their people are dressed and how things are handled and so forth. And I know that God's preparing me for what's ahead, and I look forward to it. I really do. Because they're not going to like what they hear, and they're going to hear it a whole lot stronger and with a whole lot more power. And that's why there's power given at the end for the last 3.5 years to do certain things, to humble people, to humble religions in this world, to humble traditional Christianity, to humble Judaism, to humble Islam. All three of them are going to be humbled mightily. They truly are. Anyway, going back to the story here, story flow, under the heading Man's True History. The reality is that you can only understand what is true in man's history when you know how God has been working with man through the ages. Through time, man has not acknowledged his own beginning. He chooses to ignore it. Far too many people say they believe in God, yet they choose to believe they crawled out of slime and evolved into man. not only has man not accepted the truth about his own beginning, he has not accepted the truth about each step along the way. I think of Genesis 1:1. I marvel at how simple it is. You know, just turn over there. It's so simple. And yet people don't understand the most simple, the most basic of things having to do with what God is doing. And so there's great debate. You know, because people go out here and just like this thing in the news this morning, I can't remember where it was, some riverbank where, in the Carolinas, I don't remember where it was. But anyway, you see this guy out there, he's working with this giant shell tortoise, you know, turtle, soft shell turtle that they found that's 30 million years old. And so, you know, there's evidence out here that something was on this earth before man was ever here. And if it goes along with the Bible and different ones, religious people that say, oh, man's only been here about 6,000 years, how does this all jive? And they can't put it together. They just don't get it. And there are those who try, they come up with all kinds of reasoning. Some of the most idiotic is that there were dinosaurs on the earth before the flood. And that's how they got rid of all the dinosaurs and so forth, is because they were around when Adam and Eve were around. And I don't know if any of you have heard some of those things, you know, that they're Tyrannosaurus Rex. Anyway, you think, how long did they scheme at that one? But what's amazing, what's kind of scary, is a whole lot of people say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and they believe it. Yeah, there were, you know, some religious fellow comes along and teaches that, and a whole bunch of people believe it. Yeah, they were around until the flood, and that's how God got rid of them, so that people can flourish on the earth without having to, you know, all these populations. Can you imagine having large cities and having to worry about putting up the kind of fences it would take and the habitat and so forth to keep out these creatures? Anyway, stupid ignorance of man. Man thinks he's so smart, so intellectual. Slime crawling out of the water and one day walking upright. And oh, now they found this great big thing. You see it in China? I think that was just last week. They found a bird skeleton that could stand eye to eye with Brontosaurus. You know, the big belly thing, the great big thing with a huge body and a long, long, long neck way up in the air and a little head. And there's this bird that could look right at him pretty much in the face, looks like, on some of these things they're showing by diagrams this last week on TV. But anyway, you know, and they can't, man, how does he fit in the picture of this? And if God did all these, it just doesn't agree with what the Bible says. So people just disregard the Bible. Isn't that a whole lot easier? I'd rather believe something else. Anyway, I'm amazed here. In Genesis 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And people can't deal with that. They can't understand that. And if they come to understand, you know, as time goes on, they'll understand it's talking about a beginning, a specific beginning of in time, of things that begin to take place. It says on the earth, it says without form and void. So there's a point in time here, and even here, to understand as people learn, and it's not that hard. You know, it doesn't take that much to go back and do it. Just if some religious scholars, supposed scholars, just look at a couple of words here to understand that the word here is became. It's like the same word that's used concerning Lot's wife, that she became salt, you know, a pillar of salt. It's the exact same word here. It's not the word was. It doesn't say she was a pillar of salt. It says she became, you know, a pillar of salt. But it says something happened. The earth became without form and void. Something changed. Something altered the way the earth was. But, you know, why bother doing all that study over two little words when you already have your mind made up as to what happened? Because you'd rather believe that you crawled out of the slime and evolved. And finally, what an awesome thing. There were dinosaurs on this earth. There were creatures on this earth that they unearthed. That giant tortoise, 30 million years old or whatever it was, give or take 20 million years, because they really don't have any idea. But anyway, you know, if it's 20 million years, 30 million years, or 100 million years old, it's really kind of immaterial. The reality is man has only been here for almost 6,000 years. And it's so easy to be reconciled, but the world doesn't want to understand that. People don't want to understand those things. Even religion, with all that they go through, to understand how man could be here 6,000 years doesn't grasp something so simple. And it really is simple, what we understand. That there's a being who rebelled, Lucifer. who rebelled became Satan, the devil. Rebelled against God and used tremendous power to destroy everything that was on this earth. Didn't want God's plan. Didn't want man to come into being. Didn't understand what God was going to do and how God was going to do it. And he still doesn't understand to this day what God's going to do at the end time here. There are certain things, brethren, that sometimes are difficult to deal with in time, because not everything is to be revealed. Not even now. Truly. We're going to learn a whole lot more about that as time goes on. Some of it not till the very end. Because God has a purpose why he does everything that he does the way that he does it. And some of it still has to do with that being in a third of all the angelic realm that rebelled with him, with Lucifer. They became demons who are still on this earth, who broadcast in the air. What an incredible thing when they're going to be able to be put away for 1,000 years, not to hurt man, not to broadcast in their perverted, distorted, sick ways anymore to the minds of human beings. I look forward to that day. That's going to be great freedom right there in itself for mankind. When those beings are no longer around to harass, to cause problems, to stir up things in the world. We have bad enough nature as it is, as human beings, without them constantly there. You know those little cartoons that I grew up with? I don't know about you, but these two little things, one on each shoulder, one saying, oh, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do that, and the other one saying, yeah, it's more fun. You know? It's not a whole lot unlike what it is in the world, except the one that's constantly there, the other is not there, unless you're called, and then God will take care of everything. But the one being, he's there broadcasting, and those that are with him, they're constantly broadcasting. They truly are. In all kinds of emotions and attitudes, mostly it's attitudes and the spirit, you know, a discouraged spirit, an angry spirit, distorted and twisted in every way. Different things that they broadcast, and sometimes if somebody's going through a certain thing, whatever that, if there's a jealousy, they just make it worse. They stir it up more to make it harder so that you can't resist as a human being unless you know what's going on. With God's Spirit, we have a hard enough time, a difficult enough time resisting and dealing with those kinds of things. But we see them, the quicker we can see them, the more we can come before God and ask God to rebuke that kind of attitude and that kind of spirit, and to help us and to rebuke anything that might be around us broadcasting to us. Sometimes we don't understand why we can switch or have such things harassing us like they do. But anyway, I'm getting sidetracked there away from the trunk of the tree here, what we're talking about in Genesis. But it's very basic. And those who are new out here, I'm saying some of these things for those who are new, just to have it more deeply embedded in your mind what took place. There was that rebellion that God stopped, that God put a halt to, but it destroyed all the earth and everything that was on it. Took the earth out of its normal rotation and orbit so that life couldn't exist on the earth. Certain things, as an example, were frozen instantaneously. You know, I think of some things that have been found in Siberia, mammoths, you know, in ice. Things that happened so quickly, other things that were destroyed and buried because of Satan's rebellion. No life could exist after what he did. That which entered in the atmosphere, we can only liken it to something of a massive nuclear war, where we understand in this world that there's enough nuclear power to destroy this earth 40 times plus over. You know, it only takes once. And with that, with just the first time, there would be such a nuclear winter because of everything that's raised up in the atmosphere for some nuclear weapons going off, that the sun wouldn't shine on the earth. It couldn't get through. Well, that's similar to what happened then, because, you know, when it happens instantaneously like it did then, that's why things froze instantaneously when water overflowed them and waters froze when you find a mammoth or the things they find sometimes that are prehistoric that are still preserved in ice. You know, it happens so quickly. It happens so fast. And yet people don't have an answer for that. It's like, well, this glacier came along and different things. Well, duh, I wonder if it took that mammoth. Must have been pretty slow. He didn't get out of the way, or he fell in the water and it froze and it happened instantaneously. And, you know, they don't have... You wonder if science flies out the window in some of these things. But anyway, it happened immediately. And the earth, as it says here, became without form and void, or it was without, became without form and void. In other words, it says, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And so the sun wasn't shining through to the surface of the earth. Nothing could grow. Nothing could live on this earth. The atmosphere was filled with debris and so forth, and it was out of kilter. So God came along. It was time to put man on the earth, time to put life on the earth, and he remolded and refashioned the earth. It's so simple. But people don't like that simplicity. And so it talks about him dividing the light from the darkness, verse 4. There's certain things he had to deal with in the atmosphere first. He began to separate various things concerning the waters on the earth and the divisions of boundaries and so forth and land masses and raising them up out of the ocean and putting some back down and making the earth what he wanted it to be for man to inhabit it once again. Setting the earth in its proper orbit and so forth. And establishing a time cycle. And some words here that we're not going to go into right now, but some that I refer to sometimes in Leviticus 23 where it talks about those, there are certain things that are appointed times that God set. Some of the words that are used here, when God established time concerning the seven-day cycle and the week and the month, the year and the day, the 24-hour, and all those things that God began to establish. And he talks about the reason he did it was for appointed times, so that man could tell time, so that God could have it into the future, that man would always know when the seventh day came. Man would always be able to tell when to observe certain holy days and certain holy time to come before God, because that would be the most important thing that man would do in his life on the earth, is to know why he's on the earth and to come before God every Sabbath in a holy convening, a holy convocation, so that God could teach him and remind him. And on the seventh day, the day that God rested, so that you never forget that, so that you always remember that was a day that was consecrated. That was a day that was set apart as holy. And no man can come along and change it to Friday or Sunday or any other day of the week or Monday or whatever day people out here like to worship on, you know, to their God. It's the seventh day. And then annually, man to come before God and to learn again in a magnified way the very thing about the Sabbath of why we're here from Passover to the last great day. And yet man doesn't have that peace of mind. I think about what's coming, you know, and I think of what's happened in the last few years that I don't have the same thoughts, same feelings about death that I used to have. I really don't. I truly do not have the same feelings about death that I once had. Because as we grow, we begin to see things more through the mind of God, through what He's given us to see. And there are some things where, for mankind, death is the way it should be. For man, for physical human beings. There comes a time where we've lived our life and that's what should be next. We like to grasp a hold of every moment and because we're not sure that there's anything beyond as human beings. But the more we see God's plan and purpose, the more we become convicted of what God is doing, the more awesome it is, and the more we begin to realize this earth is a sick world to live in. This world is not what God wants for man. It's what man has chosen for man. And there's great suffering on the earth because of what man has chosen. It's man's fault, not God's fault, for what's happening on the earth. And I don't want to get ahead of myself because that's in the book here a little bit farther. We'll get to it in a moment. But our perspective of death begins to change because God has the power to resurrect. And everyone who dies, because the vast majority of, in God's plan, the vast majority that would ever be a part of human life, their whole purpose is to live again in a different world, in a different age, in a different time, when God is going to give them knowledge of His way of life and they're going to be able to compare it with what they had before when they had their own life to live their own way. And they're going to be able to make a sound, just judgment in their mind in comparison to the two to be able to choose what they truly want for themselves, which will not be the world the way it is now. So it's an awesome thing what God is doing and how God is doing it. But again, in Genesis here, it talks about God made the firmament and divided the waters from the firmament from the waters that were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. You know, there's that atmosphere around the earth that God made. So there'd be that which would be able to inhabit. Birds that can fly through the air. Not too high. You know, oxygen gets a little thin the higher up you go. There are certain things that God made so that life could flourish on the earth. All kinds of life. In the seas, in the waters, and in the atmosphere, in the air. and on the ground. Incredible. And man's been here for about 6,000 years. But man doesn't understand that. He doesn't understand his own history because he doesn't want the knowledge of God. Going on in the book, God said concerning man, and this is in Romans 1:28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, has man wanted to retain God? Well, it makes it very clear throughout the Scriptures. No, man has not wanted God, not at least the way God revealed himself. They want to create God after their own image, after what they like, after something that's a little farther away, and when he's needed, hey, we'll call upon him, you know. But let's not get too serious about this. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind. Why? What does this mean? God let them go their own way. He gave man the ability to make his own choices in life. And because man did not choose God, God allowed for man to be able to choose his own way. That's what it's saying here. Which leads to one direction. A twisted, distorted, reprobate mind. A distorted mind. A mind that does not understand. A mind that cannot see what is best for itself. Truly. A mind filled with every kind of get. Jealousy, envy, hatred, greed, pride that fills life. A reprobate mind. A mind void of judgment is what this means. A mind void of sound judgment, which comes only from God. And so if we don't choose God, we cannot have sound judgment and a sound mind. And that's what's wrong with the world today. So in the church, when God calls us, we begin to grow more and more in a sound mind. We become more sound. We begin to be able to deal with our past, with our lives, with the things that made us the way we are, our own nature. And we begin to deal with it. We begin to see things from a different mindset. The one true mind that we're all to come in harmony and unity with, that gives real peace, lasting peace for all eternity. Going on in the book. And in these verses, God is simply saying that since man does not choose to know him, then he, God, will release him, distance himself from man, so that man can experience the consequences of his wrong choices, resulting in human suffering and the pollution of his mind. Because God made us free moral agents to choose our own way. And so man doesn't want God. He hasn't chosen the way of God. And it's sad. But it's a needful thing. It has to be this way and there's no other way. That's the exact reason that man has to suffer like he does in the end of the 6,000 years. To be humbled. So he can give thought to and weigh what God places before him. To be brought low so that he can look at a different way. The true way of life to live. And so, I mentioned this a moment ago, started to get into it, but man has caused his own problems. This is why I get upset when people ask questions or they make comments, and sometimes even in the environment of the church, this has existed in times past, and it's like this horrible time that's coming. And sometimes in the interviews, some people unloaded on God, well, why would God do this? No, you get it wrong. Man's doing this. Man's doing this. We would have destroyed ourselves a long time ago if God hadn't held back the technology. I hope you marvel at that. I do. I sometimes think about this. I think about where we are in time, the technology we have. Amazing. All the time of human history before this. Nearly 6,000 years, and man didn't have what we have today. And all of a sudden, the knowledge that's rampant out there and how fast things are moving in a particular direction of technology and the ability, because of discovery, the ability to use electricity, finally, that which led to something I'm using here today on the top of this table, a computer, you know, and they're getting smaller and smaller and holding more and more information, and the way man is able to do things is so much quicker, so much faster. It's awesome. It's absolutely incredible. I think if people are going to be resurrected later on, and it's going to take them a long time. They're going to be in such awe at things they see. And you can explain it a little. You're a little, sometimes I'm a little intimidated by certain programs. And you think about people are going to be resurrected and what they're going to see. And what we've seen in the last 20 years the last 30 years in our lives. Awesome. But all it had to be so, because if God allowed that technology a long time before this, we would have destroyed ourselves a long time ago, because man uses the technology to his own self-destruction, his own hurt, his own suffering because of greed, selfishness, and everybody wanting to be first, just like what's happening today. God prophesied that there'd be little peon nations, puny little nations, who would roar like a lion and have great power. How's that possible? We're seeing it. Everybody wants a nuclear bomb. Everybody wants a nuclear weapon in their little arsenal. Venezuela would love to have it. Brazil wants to have it. Most of South America, they'd like to have it. Most of the Middle East now, Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, you know, they'd like to have that kind of power. Because, and then it's a giant chessboard, and can't even get into that, can we? Amazing world we live in. Well, man's going to destroy himself. It's God that intervenes, that stops it. It's just God has held it back by not giving us technology, by not allowing us to know what electricity is. He has kept that back from human beings for thousands of years. And we're too dumb as human beings to grasp that, to be able to look at something even logically and say, how is it possible that human beings with our minds haven't evolved in 6,000 years. Matter of fact, there are things that, as far as man's ability to build certain things, we're still dumbfounded by it. We can't even use our stupid computers to figure out how they built the pyramids. And some of the things that human beings have done in times past still baffles the minds of people to try to figure it all out. Amazing, amazing, amazing. See? So were people dumber back there when they built the pyramids? No, they're pretty sharp cookies to do some of the things they did. That man has tried to duplicate some things and they can't figure it out. They truly can't. So it wasn't because man was more stupid back then. By any measure, God held back the ability to learn certain things in science and technology and so forth, because we wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been held back. And now it's being allowed to go its full gamut to bring us up to exactly where we are in time. God is in full control. He knows the human mind and has worked with nations and peoples and that which we're able to discover for ourselves through time, through what God, when He opens the door for that. Because it's time. Not by chance, not by coincidence, but by God's time, because He promised we would have 6,000 years to govern ourselves, to prove we're miserable in doing so. We can't do it. We don't know the way to peace. Those are powerful words, and I don't know sometimes if we really grasp how powerful those are. Man does not know the way to peace. Only in the church do we know. Because it's just not by knowledge. Israel never had it. They were given the Ten Commandments. They never had peace. You know, well, they had it for a short spurt in time, depending on the individual and their relationship with God, like David or whatever. You know, but as a whole, they never had peace. Judah fought with Israel. You know, isn't that an amazing thing? You try to explain that to someone. The first time you find Jew in the Bible is when the Jews were, you know, when Israel was at war with the Jews, or vice versa. There, you know, and you think, well, how is that possible? You know, they don't think that far. So I think of little children and how sometimes people in the church have had difficulty dealing with this. Well, how could God allow little children to suffer like that, to be killed in such a massive way in the world? Aren't they innocent and fully innocent? True. Is God causing the death of millions and billions of little children? No. There will be a day when He does. On the very last day, when He intervenes, when God does what He's going to do to Asia, to Russia and China and to Europe and that power in Europe that arises, you know, that conquers this country, and then all those countries that go to war with each other finally, Asia and Europe, when they battle each other, and God puts a halt to it in one day's time, destroys millions and millions and hundreds of millions of people on the earth in one day, including little children. A merciful, loving God to humble the earth, to humble mankind, to humble those nations. Because, see, this one's already been humbled long before that. But to finally humble even those Gentile nations, so that when His kingdom comes, there will be that which starts with a big bang as far as the millennium is concerned, and that which God begins to rule. And there are things there, brethren, we don't even begin to grasp yet of what God is doing and how He's doing it and why He's doing it this way. If we think about those things, pray about those things, we'll learn much, we truly will, from a very powerful, merciful, loving God. Every one of those individuals, whether they live on into the millennium or are resurrected in a moment, they continue on with their life in the great white throne. Time is nothing with God. Time is nothing with God. It is to us. And so we hold on to it with every gasping breath sometimes because we don't have confidence of what is beyond. But with God, it's different. The more we see things, as I mentioned earlier, as God does through His mind, which is what it is, the more we come into unity and agreement with God, the more we begin to see why God does and is doing the things He is, and we become in greater and greater awe of it. And the more we truly learn in that light, the more in awe we will be of God. And so what He does from one moment in time on that last day, that last incredible day, on this just before, this, on the same day that Jesus Christ is returning, and those things that take place on that day, those individuals who die, they're going to be resurrected into a world that we can't even begin to describe. We can't even picture in our own mind yet of what is going to happen with 1,000 years of rebuilding this earth. And so whether they live as a part of a foundation into a new world, into a new age, or are resurrected later on, what does that mean? And what is the difference? What is the difference? I'll tell you what. That which is that period of time beyond in that great white throne is much greater and much better than what you have at the beginning of the millennium. Think about that for a while. Death means nothing to God for a human being because He has the power of life and death. And so sometimes if we're not careful, we can begin to judge God by our judgments and thinking of, oh, the poor little children. Man has done this to himself. And man is destroying the children and the adults and everything else in between. And when God does it on that one day to level a playing field, to establish certain things for the millennium, to have things in a right beginning and a right start for what's going to be accomplished for 1,000 years, well, we have much to learn, brother, and we truly do. Things that we can't even receive yet. And so again, I marvel sometimes at interviews and sometimes in the environment of the church that people unwittingly so condemn God, judge God, because we just don't get it. And in the area of, you know, what was that article, that booklet at one time? Why did God let Tommy die? Or what is the name of it? Was something like that? Or why did Tommy die? I don't think it was why did God let Tommy die, but it was why did Tommy die? Or any of you remember that old? Yeah, well, you don't remember the title? I think it was even Tommy, but anyway. Who? Johnny? Oh, we've got a lot of names being thrown out here now. It really is immaterial. It was a child anyway, and the question was, why would God let a child die? Or why did He die? And it's like, it's, you know, mankind thinks, well, it's God's fault if something like that happens, and why would God allow these things to happen to people? They just don't get it because they can't get it yet. Look at how long it's taken for us to grasp and comprehend God's plan and God's purpose and why things are happening. So there's some things you can't give to people. You know, they're just things in life you cannot give to people. God has to, because it's a spiritual thing. It's of the mind. And God has to open the mind for people to be able to receive those kinds of things. But we're at that point in time where God's getting ready to do that in a very powerful way. Going on in the book. As a result of man choosing to keep God completely out of the picture, or at least at a more comfortable distance away, does it remind you of anything? Started in the very beginning, Adam and Eve. Let's get in the shadows of the trees. Let's get in the woods here a little ways, you know. And basically, it's like God can't see us there. You know, if he doesn't, aren't we bright? But that same thing that happened then is the way man has been ever since. It's like, keep God farther away, and the more He's away from the mind, out of mind, whatever that expression is, out of sight, out of mind. And so you take him out of your sight in one respect. He's out of mind, definitely. A little reverse on that. But anyway, it's amazing. God's there. God sustains everything in the universe, and we don't even grasp that. Everything. God knows everything that's happening to everything in the universe. Always. We can't even begin to grasp the power in the mind of God. That's why there's always only one eternal God who is who He is, and no one else will ever be like Him in that regard. As to God Almighty, Yahweh Elohim, it's impossible. Jesus Christ is the only one that is brought the closest. And He's not the Father, and He's not Yahweh. And then we are next, as far as mankind is concerned, to be made like unto the image of His Son, Jesus Christ, but never be like Him because He is unique. His Father was God Almighty, and we don't grasp all those things yet. But anyway, so again, as a result of man choosing to keep God completely out of the picture, or at least at a more comfortable distance away, he has twisted and misrepresented his history in order to ensure that God is kept at bay. Rather than acknowledging that any of his existence is connected to God, man has fashioned history to reflect his own vanity and pride. To make this point clear, you need to ask, how many history books tell of man's true beginning? How many teach about our first parents, Adam and Eve? Do you get the point? How sick is man when he will not even accept the beginning that God said he gave to man? Do you truly believe that man likes to retain the knowledge of God, his very creator? This is precisely why man has now entered the final stage of his end time judgment in 6,000 years of botched history. You know, there's so much in the Bible said, brother, and I don't know if it's hit us fully yet, even though it's been mentioned many times, that we're talking about a time here spoken of throughout the Bible of judgment. Oftentimes we think of a final judgment or something that's way, way off in the future for human beings, and we don't grasp that so much of what is spoken of in the Bible about a time of judgment is where we're at right now. It's where we're headed into right now. Because 6,000 years of man's ways are coming down into a judgment that this earth is getting ready to reap now. All human beings are going to be judged when it comes time, but that judgment is going to be when they're given the truth. And the world has never been given the truth in the sense of the ability to retain it, because they have not been called, because it was not a part of God's plan, nor would it be possible. There are certain things God could have done throughout history, but this is the best, the most powerful way to bring those into His family that have lived over 6,000 years. Man has to experience this to its fullest, and that is an awesome thing to come to understand. But the reaping of what mankind is going to reap is right now, and what's in front of us in the following, over a short period of less than 4.5 years now, it'll all be over with. Incredible. Going on. So, how truthful is our history? Man doesn't accept the story of Adam and Eve as part of his history. He does not accept or teach the history of Noah and the flood. Not even those who claim to be religious as a whole believe the story about Noah. And they so disbelieve about a flood, they think, well, there was just this little regional thing that took place over there in Mesopotamia. In a little part of the world, there's just a little bit of a flood over there, and it was in that part of the world. Because people, it's like, how could God do that? It's like we restrict God and the power of God to do certain things. And if He can create this whole earth, I think He can bring about a flood over the whole thing, if that's His purpose, to destroy all life. Every animal, everything that's out there, if that's His purpose. So even today, people just don't believe the story of Noah. A lot of religions out here that call themselves Christian teach it as it's a kind of nice story to learn some lessons from. Didn't really happen, but it's a nice little story, kind of like a fairy tale type thing that has some good principles in it, you know. Amazing, amazing, amazing. The stupidity. I guess I do use that once in a while about man. Because when he rejects God, we are stupid. We're blooming idiots.
to reject God,
to reject the knowledge and the truth of God, to hold on to our own pride. We're just not too bright. I mean, you can't call that smart, can you? You can't call that real intellectual. So what's the opposite of being really intelligent and intellectual? Certain words come to mind. Moron, stupid, you know, whatever. He does not accept or teach the history of Noah and the flood. These two things alone keep man from learning the most basic lessons of life. History should teach us how to live in the present as well as the future. As some people in the world have experienced, after it is too late, if we do not learn from the mistakes, the lessons of the past, we're destined to repeat them. This is exactly what has been going on ever since we were put on this earth, a complete failure to learn from our mistakes and to turn to God. That's why God is going to bless mankind with the ability, with one powerful event, the end time, tribulation, that'll last for 3.5 years, so that man could begin to truly learn from his past and from his history and from his mistakes, and God give the ability and the power and the strength then to be fully focused on the might of God and the way of God, so that these things aren't repeated. Because you see, there will be no more allowed on the earth, no more wars. Some are going to try to muster up one at the end, and God just isn't going to allow it. They're going to get the beginnings of it, but they're not going to be able to follow through. That boggles my mind still. And the only way I can deeply believe that now is because I saw what happened in Laodicea. We lived through it. That an entire church could do what it did, that had the impregnation of God's Spirit and could fall asleep or fully turn from God and go back to what it was drawn out of. Amazing. Amazing what's going to happen at the end of 1,000 years when Satan lives for a little season. And yet it's going to happen. We know it. And we believe it. I believe it more deeply. Understand it, I guess, more deeply. We always believe what God says. But to understand it more deeply because of what we've experienced in Laodicea. Going on in the book, as in the movie Groundhog Day, you know, feel sorry for some other countries who haven't gotten the movie. Certain things you use sometimes as expressions or whatever that sometimes I use, and people in other countries say, what does that mean? You know, sometimes you can kind of tell by expression what it might mean and what it's saying. But as in the movie Groundhog Day, man has been living life, repeating the past, our history, over and over and over, trying to get it right, except we never do. This is why God is now going to intervene and save us from ourselves. God is going to bring an end to 6,000 years of man's way, man's government, man's religion, and man's own self-inflicted misery. Now think of traditional Christianity and all the smug, pious, self-righteous attitudes that are in the world of people who believe so deeply in that they're right and everybody else is wrong. They condemn everyone else on the earth, not understanding they're some of the greatest hypocrites alive that walk the face of the earth, and they do not see it. They're going to come face to face with their hypocrisy. They truly are. God's going to bring that about. Man's religion is the greatest cause of all of our problems and all of our woes on this earth, because it's turned everyone away from the true God. They all have. All that had the potential, any potential that might be there whatsoever, in remembering what Abraham did and what Abraham taught his children, that they did not live up to, that they did not believe and accept and receive. I think of those that came through the flood, that did not accept and believe and hold on to what Noah said. And they experienced the waters. They experienced the animals that came on. And they rejected God. Not a one of them is noted as being righteous. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Not a one of them. It jumps from Noah to Abraham. Incredible. Incredible. That three people, well, the rest of them as well, we might as well throw the rest in, because Noah's the only one, righteous Noah. The rest were not noted, not recorded as being righteous. And believe me, they were not. Amazing. Every one of them. And the wives. And the children that came later on didn't choose to believe their grandparent and what had taken place. And yet you know the story was told. It's like, well, it's like going over here to Kings Island amusement park and having some kind of ride. They're talking about it. Boy, we had a ride. You know? and don't believe a thing, why it happened and what took place and what God had to say. Didn't want to uphold the righteousness, the ways of truth and the truth of God. I tell you, that really blows the mind, but it just shows how bad human beings are. And if we'd been there, we'd done exactly the same thing. There's not a one of us that shouldn't think we wouldn't have done exactly as Shem, Ham, and Japheth did. We would have. God has to draw you. God has to help you to begin to see your own rotten mind and mine. Our minds are rotten, reprobate, void of judgment until God begins to give us judgment, soundness of mind through the power of His Holy Spirit. Amazing. Going on. You live at the pinnacle of all human history. I think of that every once in a while. I was thinking about that the other morning. Of all the times, I'm always in awe of that when my mind goes in that direction. Of the time period I get to live in, the end of 6,000 years. If I were to pick it out, I couldn't have picked out a better time period to have been born. And to have the opportunity of being a part of the Church of God, that even goes far, far beyond that. To grasp what we have, what we've been given, to be able to witness what's happening, what God is going to do on this earth, what's happened in the church, to be able to teach others and to tell others about that in the future during the millennium and during the great white throne. Words just don't grasp. And so many of us, we still, as time goes on, brother, sometimes we don't grasp but appreciate the depth of what God has given to us in this time to have the blessings that we have, the awesomeness of it all. I don't have words to express it. You live at the pinnacle of all human history. Before man was ever created, God purposed to allow him to have his own governments and religions for a 6,000-year period. This time has come and is almost complete. Time has run out for man. Amazing. 6,000 years. You know, it's so basic. I think of the 7-day week that God has given to us, to mankind, to understand if we were to hold true to that one thing, to be able to grasp what God is doing, to understand what is there and what it teaches, the Sabbath itself, about a plan that God has for the future. A day is as 1,000 years. That plan that's in the 7-day week, 7,000 years has been given to mankind. Because you see, after 7,000 years, no one else will be added to the family. If you understand what I'm saying. No more human birth after 7,000 years. It's over with. Now, there's going to be a great resurrection of people who've lived before. But no more births. No one else brought along. That's it. God gave 7,000 years for His overall plan and purpose of bringing all who have opportunity to become a part of His family, to be born into life, to have opportunity, most resurrected in the great white throne that follows the 7,000 years, into physical human bodies again. Most profound. I think about what we know and what we understand about life and God's desire after 7,000 years, to bring everyone back to human life again, a physical life again. It is so marvelous to understand, to have that knowledge. It truly is. Sometimes we, if we're not careful, we can begin to take for granted what we have. And we don't understand the riches we have. Everything is God's, and what we have is the most precious of all. It's what's in our mind, what God has given to us. Let's go back to Exodus. I think it'd be good just to look at this. The 7-day week. Again, so much of this for helping new people and becoming more fully grounded and appreciative and understanding of God's plan and God's purpose and what it's all about. Going back here to Exodus chapter 20. We've been here recently, but let's read it again here concerning this phase. Put it into an overall picture. Because God pictures by the 7-day week a 7,000-year plan. And that's what's so profound about all this. And so in verse 8 of chapter 20, it says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." And that means set aside the Sabbath day. That's what it means to keep it holy. Traditional Christianity, the world, says something about keeping something holy. They get this pious thing about them, and the mind just, you know, goes off base. I think of a couple we sat down beside it in Turkey, in Istanbul, at a little restaurant, and they were from Beverly Hills area, California, and we were talking about some things there, and we had talked for quite a long time, and really some very good conversations, some things we were sharing together there, and then all of a sudden that old question came up: what do you do? And I thought about telling them I'm an author. You know, because, you know, they don't really, you know, it's just a matter of conversation and maybe a little bit of interest because there was a friendship developing there, you know, in that respect of something that was there that if we were in the same area, you know, we'd continue on with if it was in the world. But I'm a minister. And so don't generally tell people that. I said, because we begin to be treated a little bit differently. That's why I don't. So, you know, I'm telling you, but, you know, as a whole, most times we don't, because people begin to treat you differently. And not like most people think of a minister. Amen to that one. you know, and the concepts that people have, because people have in their mind this pious thing or whatever they've grown up with, and these people running around in robes or whatever it is, and or chains around their neck or their collar on backward, you know, and different ideas that people have, and think you've got to talk religiously, and you know, I can't stand that. And anyway, sure enough, she couldn't help herself. She started talking about something they just learned about, what someone had just told them about different religious leaders and seeing them in the community, and she just couldn't help herself, you know, and she went off on this tangent, and I thought, oh boy. But anyway, you know, incredible, some of the things we live through, and the stories of different things here of people not being able to understand things that are so basic in life, and we're so different, brethren, we truly are. How do you keep something holy? It's not the way man thinks of it. It's in truth. You keep something holy because you obey God. It just means to set something apart for holy, in essence, a holy use and purpose. God, that's what God is saying. To have something that God set apart. He said He made the Sabbath day holy. And if you understand those things, if you understand what He's saying, it means that God made it, He put His name in that day. He set it apart from other days of the week. It's to be special. It's to be acknowledged as something in a relationship to your God. It's to be set apart for holy use and purpose, not to be treated like the other 6 days of the week. See? And in that, we learn a great lesson that God is bringing a time to this earth, 1,000 years, that's to be set apart for holy use. It is an awesome thing, because here's where the knowledge of God goes throughout the earth. And all mankind now has the opportunity to be a part of the church of God, the body of Christ, to receive the impregnation of God's Spirit all over the earth. You don't have to worry about what other people think about Friday sunset to Saturday sunset and your job. Because everyone will think the same. There will be one church, one religion on the earth, one government on the earth. Something that we can't fully grasp yet because we haven't lived in that kind of a world. But that's what's coming. But that's what the Sabbath day is to teach us. That's a part of what it's to teach us. And so the seventh day is to be unique. Remember the Sabbath day. To keep it, there are things you have to do. You can't work. You realize there are things you shouldn't do on that day. Those of you who are new, I get a lot of questions from people about, well, what do you do on the day? So I try to direct them to sermons, because people aren't going to have the opportunity of what some of us had when we were called, to be able to go to a Sabbath service and be with others and begin to learn more about what you do on the Sabbath, and especially the opportunity of coming together on the Sabbath to spend that time together as a family, preparing when you're certain to be in services and the fellowship you're able to have after. There's so many who are never going to have that experience, not even some who are brand new here, who are being drawn, who are being called. There is a person right now down in the Canary Islands off the coast of Spain, off the coast of Africa, I'm sorry, it's a part of, belongs to Spain. And trying to come up all the way up to United Kingdom when we're up there in order to be baptized. Been on fire, desiring to be baptized for some time now, and that fire is getting greater and greater. But they just sent me an email this morning. She made a comment about how that after what she's read, she realizes this may be her last chance, and she wants to have that opportunity before we are thrust into what we're being thrust into, because she knows that during that 3.5 years as a whole, no one's going to be able to be baptized for that 3.5 years as a whole, you know, and to be able to have fellowship and so forth. And so going to be baptized and have to go all the way back down there and listen to the sermons on the internet like she's doing. You know, she's going through right now some of the sermons of 2006 in the Feast of Tabernacles. She says, the more I learn, the more I burn and desire to be baptized, you know, because she believes this way of life fully and completely. And I think, you know, what an amazing thing. All the way down there by herself. And probably in that location of the world, going to be by herself for quite a long time. And so, what an incredible thing. People today that are being drawn are not going to have the same opportunities to learn about how to observe the Sabbath and to keep it holy. And it makes it a little more difficult when you can't have fellowship and the time then spent in the day and how you use your time during that day. But still, people are doing that. And they're learning to set that time aside, primarily to listen to the sermons today. As an example, during this very period here in the United States and Canada. Others record it, take it off, and listen to it next Sabbath. Those in Australia, New Zealand, and other parts of the world. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work. So there's a routine of life we live by, that concerning our occupation that we go through. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. That 1,000 years is coming. It belongs to God. It isn't man's any longer. God intervenes. God brings His way to this earth in a very powerful way. He brings man into that 1,000 years in a very powerful way. It's been set aside by God a long, long time ago. You know, we look forward to the Sabbath day. God looks forward to the Sabbath day. You know why? It's His opportunity to work with us in a very special way. His opportunity to live more fully through us in this day than He does other days of the week. I hope you understand that, because He does. I think of the Feast of Tabernacles. God lives through us more powerfully during the Feast of Tabernacles than any other time of the year. Because for 8 days, you receive power and strength, guidance and direction and inspiration from your great God and His Son, Jesus Christ. And it's a powerful, powerful thing that God does. And He looks forward to the Feast of Tabernacles at that time when He's going to pour out upon us much to strengthen us in order to go into the following year. I think of this coming year. I think of the last 2 years we've had in the Feast of Tabernacles and the power that God has poured out upon us. And I don't know what's coming this year, but I know it's important because it's our last one as we've known it. You know, amazing to think about that, to contemplate that, and to grasp that it's our last one for a time, that we're going to be able to come together in different parts of the country into one location. And we'll hear more about that later on, probably on the last great day. Because I'm already starting to work on some of the sermons in my mind here as I'm going to be traveling and working on some of those next few weeks and months, and pray that you be praying about that, or ask that you be praying about that. But again here, awesome to understand what God is doing and where we are, that this is His time that's coming. And He looks forward to the millennial period in ways that we can't even begin to grasp. Has for a long, long time. Long before Adam and Eve were ever created. Long before that. But now, it's coming about. Now, we're finally there. Things we can't comprehend about God and what God has done and what God has been doing and His patience and bringing about what is getting ready to take place. And so the Sabbath day, we look forward to the Sabbath day, and God looks forward to the Sabbath day. He looks forward to giving us what He's giving us today. He looks forward to inspiring us, to stirring us up, in order to go through and to grow and to go through the following week in a stronger way, or, you know, prepared and molded in fashion as we continue to grow, because it's a growing thing we go through. We become stronger as we go along, and a little bit here and a little bit there. But the Sabbath is the most important of the 7 days of the week. God lives in us more fully on this day than any other day of the week. And so it's special. And so is that 1,000 years. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor the stranger that's within your gates. Not your normal routine in the sense of your full occupation. I mentioned here a while back about slaves. And there are certain things they still did. There are certain things that had to do with the household of where they were. But, you know, as far as tilling the ground, as far as gleaning harvests or things like that, of the larger, the routine of work they had, they were not to do those things on the Sabbath day. But things having to do with food, they did. And the care in that area, they still did. Okay? And anyway. Verse 11. For in 6 days. And so God wants us to remember. He planned it all out to picture things into the future, to help us to remember, but nobody wants to remember. Save those He's called, and we remember. And they mean a great deal to us as we come to understand how much they mean to God. For in 6 days the Eternal made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them. We understand what that means as we read back in Genesis. It's not that the earth was first created. It's not that the universe was first created. But the heavens is talking about, we know what that is because we just read it back in Genesis a little while ago. The firmament in the heavens to give life so that there could be that which lives in the atmosphere around us, that which exists, that which lives in the seas, and that which lives on land. We understand what happened in those 6 days and why God remolded and refashioned the earth that had become at a point and stage where it was without form and void in essence, became that way at a point in time. And so God remolded and refashioned and put life back in on this earth. But now for His plan, mankind, who was to become a part of the God kind, Elohim, in time. For in 6 days the Eternal made heaven and earth and the sea and all that's in them, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Eternal blessed the Sabbath day, and He hallowed it. He sanctified it. He set it apart for holy use and purpose. And we learn to do the same thing as God draws us. And so there are those things that people have to deal with and work with. I think of a conversation I had with someone overseas yesterday. I won't tell you where because he's very well being drawn along. But from another nation. And he was making a comment. He's talking about how he had been around a time and worldwide for a time and some of the things he struggled with. But to make a long story short, he's not working 7 days a week, and there's certain things he's seeing, and he wanted to talk about and counsel about some of those things, and he was kind of in a bit of a quandary. And I told him, I said, you know what you have to do, and you know why you don't feel stirred up, because he's talking about how there are certain things that he has that have pricked him in the mind, but he doesn't feel stirred up and moved and motivated. And I said, well, you're working 7 days a week. You know, and God leaves it to us. There are certain things we know, and when we obey God, and the primary thing always is a Sabbath. And it's up to you to make the choice of setting that day apart and not working on that day. And until you do, if God's brought you again to this moment in time, you will not be stirred up because the choice now is yours. God has given this to you, and it's up to you what you're going to do with it. I said, you know the answer. Yeah, I do. You know, he knew what he had to do. And said, the choice is just yours. If you don't do it, you'll never feel stirred up. You'll never feel that motivation. You'll never feel that fire. But if you obey God, and He's drawing you, then you have an opportunity before you. And you'll have that fire. You'll have that zeal. And that stirring up within you that you're not sensing now and don't have in your life. Because God's not going to give you that part until you obey Him in this most basic thing, because that's the primary area where you're disobeying, obviously. So, you know, there are things about the Sabbath we ever learn about, and people out here are new, who have to begin where everyone begins. Isn't that amazing right here in this country? I truly marvel, that for repentance to take place in this country, for those who come through what they're going to come through, they're going to hear a message. It's going to ring in their minds that everything they've ever believed all their life, if it be a matter of traditional Christianity, is all wrong. And at the heart and core and the very reason of why they're suffering, even more so. Because religion has kept man away from God. Because the religion of man is not man's religion, it's Satan's. He has deceived the minds of all on this earth. He truly has. And everyone has gone the wrong direction. And that direction is away from God, into the thickness, into the deepest thickness of the forest so that God can't see them. It's an amazing thing. Well, with that, I think we'll stop there today. start on this next section. Next Sabbath. Oh, let me finish this section. Let me finish the next few paragraphs here just to get down to this next heading so that I can have a spot that's logical to begin with. Next Sabbath. Going on here, I'd mentioned time has run out for man. Going on. God has exercised great patience with man during this time in order to accomplish great things in His ultimate purpose for man. The first phase of this plan is to help us learn from such a long history, speaking of that 6,000 years, that we are incapable of successfully governing ourselves. What a witness, brethren. Through different nations, through different ideas, through different religions, through different governments, every one has failed. We cannot govern ourselves nor anyone else. Going on, all of man's governments and religions have failed. God is giving us a great gift by letting us learn this lesson. We have to learn it. Man has to learn it. For without learning this lesson, we cannot eventually go on to much greater things He has in store for us. It's profound what's said there, brethren. I hope we understand that. Only when that lesson is learned can we finally begin to attain lasting peace and true happiness. Indeed, God has had great patience with mankind because the reality is we are not owed life. It is not something we inherently deserve. It is a gift from God. Brethren, both physical and that which is beyond, that which is spiritual. This last paragraph. Since man has chosen to leave God out of his history, this book will fill in much of the gap so that you can better grasp why we are in the end time, what is coming next, and why.